From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, we check in on the future of Kansas City's African-centered schools.
Whoever chooses to, you know, have their child come, we're going to welcome them with open arms. And that means if 350 show up or if 750 show up.
The dog days of summer start early and area residents try to beat the heat. Plus, a new local storytelling project explores people's connections with farming and their identity.
This was Hereford country and everybody had Herefords, and he thought that Angus would be the coming thing and he liked to be different.
And the All-Star Games bring extra visitors to Kansas City. Hear what locals think tourists should take away from our city.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
There's been a changing of the guard at Kansas City's African-centered schools. It's a program that was started more than two decades ago by school leaders and community members who believe that teaching children from an Afrocentric perspective would lead to greater self-esteem and academic achievement. But throughout that history and turnover at the school district, leaders of the African-centered schools have clashed with district administration over the autonomy they say they need to run the schools effectively. The district has now stepped in and appointed a new principal for the African-centered campus. But the founders of the original schools and many of the parents say they're going their own way. To find out more about the split, Susan talked to the old and new leaders of Kansas City's African-centered schools.
By 2008, the African-centered program had taken root at three district schools, and leaders say they were considering applying to become a charter school. That means the school would leave the district and become accountable directly to the state. UMKC economics professor Linwood Taid is a member of the African-Centered Education Task Force, which oversaw the schools.
We had had 19 years of fighting for African-centered education in the Kansas City, Missouri school district. Some boards were agreeable, some superintendents were agreeable, some not. So we got tired of that because it was causing educational disruption. And so we decided to become a charter school. We went to the school district and at the time asked them to sponsor our charter because we still feel we have a public education connection. They, in fact, asked us not to become a charter. They asked us to become a contract school.
A contract meant that the A schools, as they're called, would have control over their own finances, hiring, and curriculum, but still be a part of the district. It was approved by the school board in 2008. Last fall, the ACE task force took the district to court. Then in March, Superintendent Stephen Green decided to discontinue the ACE contract and resume administration of the school. He said at that time, according to the Kansas City Star, that ACE leaders had not accounted for all of their funding and had, quote, deficient academic progress. Test scores show that about 30% of ACE elementary students are proficient in math and reading. But school leaders say that almost 100% of high school students are graduating and going on to college. Linwood Taid said, it's time to move on.
At this point, we are completely fed up with the district. So we are in the process of developing a charter school. Now, that's us going forward. That doesn't deal with the inequities and injustice that has been done to us.
Now, ACE leaders won't be able to apply for a charter in time for this school year, which leaves the future of about 1,000 students up in the air. Hundreds of passionate parents have interrupted district meetings in protest. Spark Bookhart is one of them.
The thing that incenses and enrages parents the most is the way and the manner of which it was done, whereby parents were not involved, were not asked, were not considered.
Bookhart says some ACE parents will continue protesting the district and are calling for the removal of the superintendent.
As parents, we're to the point where we're saying we will not be ignored any further and make it a very, very uncomfortable environment for the school board to operate in without talking to our parents going forward.
Bookhart says he and other parents he's working with will not send their children to the African-centered school that the district is restructuring, nor any other district school.
We will collectively homeschool our children. We'll collectively do whatever it takes to ensure the educational integrity of our children until the people that we know and trust, until they can have an alternative institution to place our children in, i.e. the charter, we will not participate as implements and aids in our own educational destruction.
Some parents are opting for the district's African-centered school, which will still be K through 12. About 300 students are enrolled for the fall, still far short of the 1,000 students who attended last year. And in the midst of all the backlash, a new council of elders called Wazuri was selected. They helped choose the new principal, Joseph Williams. He's originally from KC, but has been working as a teacher and a school administrator in Georgia for the past 18 years. I sat down with Williams to find out more about his vision for the school and what led him to consider taking this job during such tumultuous times.
I think it's very important for students of African descent to really know about their culture. I think it's also important for them to understand that we did contribute to society. You know, a lot of young people, when they go through the traditional K-12 setting, they only really study African history from an African perspective once we came over to America, which is fine. I mean, we live in America. However, when you start from that starting point, you're really starting from slavery. And I think it's very important for our students to understand that come from African descent, that we have contributed to society. And a lot of times that doesn't really get highlighted in their education. And I think it can help in a lot of ways. I think it can help with behavior. I think it can help with academics. And I think it can help with self-esteem overall.
So, you know, critics talk about the fact that African-centered education may be too narrowly focused. It doesn't prepare students for life in a multicultural society. It promotes an anti-white agenda. Are these fair criticisms?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at it from the perspective that any history that you study is going to be from a different perspective or from a particular perspective, we're not excluding anything. We're not, I mean, we're going to study everything that happened in history. We're just going to do it from an African-centered perspective. So let's say, for example, we're talking about the Civil War. We're still going to talk about everything that happened in the Civil War, but maybe we'll focus more on how those slaves was feeling about things as it related to the Civil War versus how Abraham Lincoln felt about it, or versus how, you know, some of the Union or Confederate soldiers felt about it. It's not that we're excluding anything. It's just we're looking at it through the eyes of African or people of African descent that, you know, might have went through various points in our history.
Now, with that in mind, why do you think parents choose an African-centered education for their children?
I think self-esteem has a lot to do with it. I mean, I think a lot of people, I think about my own self, you know, I'm in my 40s, and I mean, when I look back on my own education, there's a lot of things as it relates to African history that I know, that I knew very little about, and I'm still learning even as we speak. So, I mean, you know, when you look at that from, you know, my age and at this stage in my life, you know, and I have a young son myself, I want him to be aware of his history and not look at it from the standpoint of, oh, you know, basically my history began, you know, in the 1600s when the slave ships came over here. So I think it's very important that, you know, we understand that a lot of parents look at this as an opportunity for their kids to feel good about who they are, where they came from, and what contributions their ethnic group made to this society.
Now, you walked into a very contentious situation, it goes without saying. What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, I look at it from the standpoint of, you know, when I came here for one reason. I was given the charge to start an African, or, you know, help start or restart an African-centered school. There had been a history in this community of an African-centered school. And, you know, that's how I look at it. I mean, I my focus has always been on the children and what's best for the children. And, you know, and I want to continue that. And I feel very fortunate in having, you know, Dr. Green provide me with some of the best and brightest in this country that are at the forefront of African-centered education. I just recently had the opportunity to visit several African-centered schools in Philadelphia. I've also had the opportunity to work with Dr. Asante, who is the founder of Afrocentricity in this country. I mean, and he's the author. He's written over 70 books, and I just feel so blessed and grateful to have somebody like that mentoring me through this process. So I'm very aware that, you know, this system has made a commitment to continuing African-centered education in this system. I want to continue that legacy.
So as you face some of the protests, the angry parents, was the situation like you imagined it before you came?
Let me just say this. I don't have any problem with any parent being a vigorous advocate for their children. I mean, I think that's a fundamental right that every parent should do. As a matter of fact, I'll go a step further. I think more parents should be more vigorous advocates for their children. We can agree to disagree without being disagreeable, though. I mean, I think there's always a proper form to air your grievances and what have you. So at the end of the day, I think, you know, the parents of Kansas City are very blessed in the sense that they do have school choice, and that's not the norm in every system in this country. If they choose not to send their children to African Center Prep, then that's their right, and I would support them wholeheartedly if they choose not to do that. But I can tell you that I'm working hard along with my staff to make sure that we have a very successful start to the school year, and I can assure anyone that brings their child to their school, to our school, that we're going to treat their child like they were our children, and they will receive an African-centered education, and they will be happy with the results. Because at the end of the day, our students are going to have to meet the same academic requirements that any other student would have to meet. The only difference in our school is that they will get their education from a rich cultural perspective.
To bring up a touchy subject, what about the criticism that some parents have voiced that, well, Joe Williams doesn't really have any experience in African-centered education? How do you respond to this kind of concern?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think first and foremost, parents need to understand that this is my 9th year as an administrator. Okay, I've been an administrator since 2004, 2005. That would actually be 8 years. And before that, I was an educator for almost 9 years. So this is not my first rodeo, I mean, in terms of running a school. The only difference is, obviously, is that it is from an African-centered perspective. One thing I can say is that, once again, Dr. Green, this system has made a strong commitment to bringing the best and brightest to help us through this process. It's not like, you know, I was hired in this position. I was given no support. I was not given any training. I was not given any type of, orientation to running an African-centered school, as well as ongoing support.
So how will you build relationships with some of the parents who say they want the old ACE leadership?
Well, I mean, like I said, I guess the real question is, are they going to let their children come to the school? I mean, it's not going to be about building relationships that they don't have their children at the school. The parents that I'm going to be focused on will be the parents that have their children at the school, that believe in what we're doing, and they're going to give us an opportunity to show that we can, you know, run a very well-run school that's, you know, going to be culturally enriched, that's going to have, you know, very high academic standards, and is going to make sure that their kids get the best education they can get possible. So that's the parents that I'm focusing on. I'm focused on the parents that have enrolled their children in our school and are looking forward to, you know, continuing to have their children in an African-centered school.
You're listening to KC Currents. We're talking with Joseph Williams, the new principal for African-centered prep at the KC Moe School District. What's your unique vision for the school? What's the Joe Williams touch you hope to put on the school?
Well, I've worked in schools that have really focused on academic achievement, and I think that's one thing that might have been lost in all of this, is that there's a lot of room for improvement as far as as the academic achievement. At the end of the day, no matter what a school's theme is, you have to show that you can move the needle, if you will, for these students as far as academic achievement. And when I look at the test scores, are not where they need to be. And so, you know, my focus is going to be to make sure that in addition to providing a culturally enriched environment for our students, is that the students are successful academically. Because at the end of the day, you know, when these students are taking the ACT and the SAT, they're going to be compared against every other student in this city, state, and country, and it's important for them to be able to compete.
Well, I know previously the A schools had a pretty elaborate screening process and interview process for incoming students. Will that continue, or will it sort of be open enrollment to anyone who wants to come?
It's still going to be a signature school for Kansas City, and there is a process that every student would have to go through to become a part of the school. And obviously we have to, you know, set some benchmarks as far as GPA and what have you, and that will, the students, you know, that start this year will know by the mid-year what those benchmarks are that they need to, you know, maintain to stay in the school. So, yeah, it definitely will be some selection as we move forward.
So in your first 6 months, what are the kinds of things you have in mind to really try to set the stage for achievement?
Well, I think in any school, it's very important that order and discipline are the foundation for your school. You can't run a good school, I don't care what the theme is, without order and discipline in the school. So I think it's very important to set that as an expectation right off the bat for the students to understand that there are going to be rules and regulations in the school. And, you know, we're definitely going to have some, you know, some expectations for them as it relates to their behavior, how they, you know, go from class to class, what the uniform policy is, how they deal with adults, what their expectation is in the classroom. And I think once you set that as the foundation, along with, you know, the critical cultural piece, you know, as it relates to African-centered education, I think that that's a powerful combination to ensure that we have a good start to the school year, and that moving forward, you know, the students will understand what the expectations will be for them in our school.
Now, the last I read, about 300 students so far plan to attend the new school, and that's significantly less than the 900 students, I guess, that were there previously. What kind of problems will this pose? Will it cause any problems, for example, in funding or operations?
Well, I mean, any school, you know, has to run based upon the number of students that you have. But, I mean, as we speak right now, we're only in June. And traditionally, historically, in signature schools like this, people a lot of times wait to make final decisions on where they're ultimately going to send their child. So I'm really not concerned about that, whether it's 300 students or whether it's 600 or 800, I mean, we're going to be ready to roll, and we're going to be ready to go with the students that, you know, show up on day one, and we'll adjust the staffing needs accordingly. So we'll be fine.
Will you be consulting with the founder, who was Audrey Ballard, or are you moving forward with the national expertise primarily?
Well, I mean, you know, when I was interviewed for this position, I mean, I was asked by, you know, the people that interviewed me, would I be willing to meet with the people that, you know, were the experts in Kansas City and people that, you know, are outside of this city and state. So, I mean, I'm very open. I mean, at the end of the day, I've heard so many really good things about, they call her Mama Ballard, Queen Mother Ballard. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I would welcome that. You know, there's an old proverb that says, you know, in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. So I feel like I can learn a lot from her. She is from Kansas City. I would be more than willing to, you know, sit down and meet with her, you know, if that's something that she'd be willing to do, you know. So I'm very open to that.
Now, do you know yet how many teachers and administrators are staying from the old regime?
Well, I mean, everybody from the old regime had to apply because they were not a part of the Kansas City public school system. So we're just now getting started with the teacher hiring process. I can't really speak to ultimately how many people from the old school will be there for this upcoming year. But I do want to make something very clear. No one at any point, because this is something that has been brought to my attention on several occasions, I want to make it very clear. No one has ever told me that I could not in any way, shape, or form hire somebody from the old ACE. As a matter of fact, I will go the other way and say that, in fact, people have encouraged me to hire people from the old ACE so that there will be a more seamless transition. So I really do need to put that out there because there has been some misinformation about that.
So as you embark upon this new challenge, what do you think is important for Kansas City to know?
I think it's important for Kansas City to know that no one is going to work harder than me to make sure that this is a success.
Well, Joe Williams, thank you for being a part of KC Currents.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Joseph Williams is the new principal of the African-Centered College Preparatory Academy, which will be a K-12 school located in two buildings on the campus of the old Southeast High School.
Coming up, the dog days of summer start early in Kansas City. You're listening to KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Daily highs have hovered at or near the 100-degree mark for more than a week, and sweaty days are expected to continue throughout the month. Dan Havelitzel is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Pleasant Hill. He says that heat waves like this would be expected in late July or early August.
But to begin in June is uncommonly early, something that we haven't seen really since about 1980.
KCUR's Maria Carter has more on how people around Kansas City are dealing with the heat wave.
While many people are sticking indoors, the birds don't seem to think it's too hot outside. Red-winged blackbirds and starlings flit to and from a bird feeder at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center. Bill Graham works there. He's standing outside watching the birds and describes the weather like this.
Well, it's hot. Dry, hot, and drier.
The high heat is already causing problems for some. My neighbor, Nancy Bach, has been trying to tidy up her yard for the past month or two. About a week ago, she went outside one morning to mow. Bach thought she was doing everything right. She took breaks and was drinking water, but it wasn't enough.
I was feeling really sick, nauseated, I was dizzy, I think was the best way to put it.
She came inside, turned on the air conditioning and a fan, but said despite the heat, she was cold. She fell asleep for 4 hours. When she woke up, she was still red in the face and feeling worn out. She went to work the next morning and Googled the symptoms and realized she may have had the beginnings of a heat stroke.
So everything it kept telling me, I should have called 911, so I'm very fortunate.
Jeff Hirschberger is with the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department. He says children, the elderly, and people with medical conditions are at the highest risk of getting heat stroke or heat exhaustion, but anyone can suffer.
The thing is, everyone is at risk whenever it gets this hot out, anyone who is spending time outside.
Hirschberger says the best thing to do besides drinking water is to stay somewhere cool. One popular place to escape the heat is at a swimming pool. Cindy Campbell is in charge of the Roland Parks Aquatic Center. In her line of business, sweltering days are a good thing.
My attitude is the hotter the better. The hotter it is, the more people we have coming to the pool, and it's a good place to cool off.
If the pool's not your scene, but you still need a place to avoid the heat, experts say call 211. The United Way has a list of cooling centers. One of the places they might refer you to is a library. Casey Riley is a communications manager for the Johnson County Library. She says they get more traffic on hot days.
And we do see a lot of people come in and spend as much as 8 hours at a time. And in those cases, we generally assume that it has to do with, you know, getting in to a cool environment and getting out of the heat.
Riley says there's a lot to do in 8 hours. Watch videos, surf the internet, or keep it old school and read a book. At the Cedar Row Library in Roland Park, Amber has a bag of kids' books at her side. She and her daughter Piper are in a special area with blocks, puzzles, and other games for preschoolers. Amber holds up a book with a giant spider on the cover, and Piper counts the legs.
It's pretty yucky. He's got legs on it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
She says Piper gets restless staying inside, and their normal favorite spot, the park, is too hot.
And so we really like coming here and we get a few books, and then she gets to play with other kids, so we love it.
She says there's an added benefit. Piper, who's just about to turn 4, is already starting to read. In this heat, all types of creatures are trying to stay cool. Animal advocates say pets also need to beat the heat. Whitney Mathis works at Spay and Neuter Kansas City and says pets face a special challenge.
I mean, they're pretty much wearing a fur coat and they don't express heat as well as we do.
Pet owners should follow the same basic precautions they use for themselves. Keep cats and dogs out of the heat as much as possible and make sure they have plenty of cool water. Mathis says she likes to do something special for her pets, doggy ice cream. She blends peanut butter, carob, and water together and freezes it in an ice cube tray.
They absolutely love it. My cat even likes the peanut butter one.
Unfortunately, we can expect the early dog days of summer to stick around a little longer. The high pressure system that's causing the scorching temperatures is expected to just sit over the Midwest until at least early next week. Maria Carter, KCUR News.
For more resources on the symptoms of heat exhaustion and heat stroke, the best ways to beat the heat, and a list of cooling centers, head to kcur.org.
So we're going to keep it hot. We just looked at some of the physical effects that the heat wave is having on Kansas Cityans. Now, we'll look at the not-so-obvious impact of the prolonged severe weather. KCUR's Laura Ziegler reports that these hot spells also have had an economic ripple effect on many households.
Most people would say that probably the worst thing about this prolonged period of heat are the deaths. Officials are investigating 5 in the metro area as of Thursday. But a problem that we don't hear as much about is the economic ripple effect, the hard choices people have to make, paying their utility bills with the high cost of air conditioning or healthcare costs, for example, or their mortgage or rent. So to get an idea about what that problem looks like, I'm going to visit Cheryl Landis, who is living with her mother, her 90-year-old mother, and she is going to help us understand what some of those hard choices feel like.
Come on in.
Thank you.
Cheryl Landis's small apartment has the cozy feel of your grandmother's living room. It should. She watches 4 grandkids and her own 13-year-old son. This afternoon, 2 of them are playing with their handheld electronic games.
I have some songs on my Nintendo 3DS.
What's the game?
Mario Kart 7.
Cheryl's 90-year-old mother, Billy, sinks silently into a club chair. She also lives with them. She has chronic lung disease and dementia. Cheryl and one of her grandsons have asthma. When it's this hot and humid, they run their air conditioner all the time. They have to. Her utility bills are $200 a month, more than double what they are without the AC.
When you have the money and you're on a fixed budget, it's all gone at the first of the month. You've paid your bills.
And you pray unexpected bills don't come in, Landis says. For example, she paid $120 in unanticipated administrative costs when she changed insurance policies. She has no health insurance. She worries about a health emergency and fluctuations in the cost of necessities like gas and groceries.
Every month you don't know. You don't know when you go to the grocery store and you need like 3 loaves of bread. You don't know what it's going to cost. It's just constant change.
And so Cheryl substitutes nutritious food for cheap food. She canceled her internet and shares a cell phone with her sister. Once in a while, there's a treat.
The kids get up early, early on a Saturday or Sunday morning, and they like to go to McDonald's with their 99 cents.
It's like robbing Peter to pay Paul every month.
Every month, every month, every month, yes.
A photograph of Cheryl's husband sits on the mantel with a prayer of St. Francis of Assisi wedged in the frame. She says she's learned how to manage the household in the years since he was killed on the job. He fell off a building at a construction site. But these relentless days of summer worry her.
It's always a fight. Who is going to maybe have to wait to get paid? So it's really hard just trying to take care of the everyday things. Everyday things get you.
There's that air conditioner now.
Yeah, so it's 80 degrees in here. It's 80 degrees. It's set on 79.
Cheryl Landis says she always feels guilty when the air comes on, but they need it. And she knows she's lucky to have it. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
And now a taste of how the heat is affecting area vineyards. Missouri winemakers are watching their grapevines carefully this summer. A little stress can positively affect grape quality. But Jacob McClellan from KRCU in southeastern Missouri reports that wine experts are concerned that this year's heat and drought may be too much.
A moderate water deficit is good for grape quality, according to Anthony Pecu. He's a viticulture professor at the University of Missouri. That's especially true after the fruit turns red.
Because it helps for biosynthesis of interesting compounds, all these compounds we call it polyphenol. It's both anthocyanin and tannin, and these compounds give the color of the wine and the characteristic, the body of the wine.
But he warns too little rain and too much heat can overstress the plants and hurt its yield. He says he's already seeing drought symptoms in some vineyards. Here at River Ridge Winery in Commerce, Missouri, owner Jerry Smith feels pretty good about this year's grape crop. All of his vines are well established and handling the conditions well.
The only trouble that we've had this year is with the season being 2 to 3 weeks earlier than what we expected, from everything from budding out in the spring. It has changed the control of our midsummer pest called Japanese beetles. We've had to spray more often for those, but they're under control now.
Smith says the years 1980 and 1999 both produced the highest quality wines in Missouri. Both were years of prolonged drought. I'm Jacob McClelland.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
People in the Kansas City area have very close ties to agriculture, whether they work on a farm now or grew up on one and left, or their ancestors settled in the region to work the land. This summer, Harvest Public Media is exploring the farm heritage of people in our area in a series called My Farm Roots. Peggy Lowe is a reporter at Harvest Public Media. She stopped by Casey Kearns to tell us more about the series and introduce the very first piece. Thanks for joining us, Peggy.
Thank you.
Where did the idea for this series first come up?
You know, it kind of came up just in discussions with my boss, Donna Vestal, and our multimedia editor, Jeremy Bernfeld. Every time we're out, you know, in public talking about Harvest Public Media or meeting folks, they always say, we love to hear your stories because my grandma, you know, was on a farm. My grandfather had a farm. My mom and dad just left the farm. Or I spent my summers on a farm.
As you're reporting, I can imagine there's often a big backstory to a certain farmer that you talk to that doesn't make it into the story, which is about a certain issue.
Mm-hmm. That's true, too. You know, these people are representative of agriculture and of how the Midwest was populated, or how certain breeds of cattle became popular, or how, you know, corn acreage was multiplied over the years. They're always representative of a larger issue, but their little stories are what's the most interesting, you know, and they get to tell their stories in their own words.
Now, how have you found people to tell these stories?
Well, first, it was just word of mouth. For instance, the first one I did, I was out in Ashland, Kansas, and I was actually doing a story about hospitals, and I asked around and said, hey, we're doing this project called My Farm Roots, and we want to find interesting people. So we found someone out there in a senior citizens center. But we're also finding these stories through what I call my Harvest Network, and this is a public insight network. It's a crowdsourcing way that we are putting out queries and saying, hey, what are your farm roots? What are your connections to the land? You can file, you know, basically click on this link and file this report with us, and we can call you up and get them that way. But yeah, we're just all kind of, all the reporters right now are grabbing different stories as we're out there reporting.
Do you find that certain themes tend to come up in these stories?
Certainly family is a huge, it's a huge topic that continues to play over and over and over. You know, the family farm is exactly that, and people are very proud of their land, very proud of their heritage, and making their living off that land. So that's been a constant theme, and that's really beautiful. Also, just connection to the Midwest, which I think is also a really cool thing. You know, people on the coast don't really think that too many people live out here, and we really like hearing those stories. We think that they're really good stories. So those are a couple of themes that are coming up. Yeah.
And do you think that the new school generation of urban farmers share a similar connection to the land as the older school farmers who maybe have been farming for many generations in rural areas?
Here's what's interesting about this project, My Farm Roots. You know, Harvest Public Media covers agriculture, and so a lot of these are very hot-button issues, and they're very polarizing concepts versus, you know, organic, say, food versus traditionally raised food, that kind of thing. It becomes very political. In My Farm Roots, we're finding a common theme, and that is people who love the land and who love producing food and who love feeding people. So there is such a commonality between those two polarizing forces, the, you know, local organic and then the traditional conventional agriculture. And the reporters and I are just really enjoying that piece of it and finding some common ground among these two sides.
So we're going to kick off the series on Casey Kearns today with this story from Nan Gardner in Ashland, Kansas, which you mentioned. Can you set it up for us?
Absolutely. So this is just a great story. So I'm out in Ashland, Kansas doing this story about this small healthcare center. And Ashland, Kansas, for all of you here in Kansas City, it is a 7-hour drive one way. So I was out there. And
close
so,
to Colorado, huh?
Almost to Colorado and Oklahoma, yeah. So I asked around and someone suggested Nan. Her husband is in the senior center there. And he is basically suffering with the onset of Alzheimer's. And so Nan still lives out on their ranch. So the Gardner family is legendary in Southwest Kansas. They basically championed the Angus breed back in the 20s when everybody was still into the Hereford brand. So Nan tells some great stories, and you'll be hearing it now, about how she came in 1955. She went to the drugstore. She was actually a local teacher, and she met the love of her life at the drugstore, and she got in with the Gardner family. She married Henry, and then they started this huge sort of dynasty of Angus breeding.
Well, let's hear that.
My name is Nan Gardner, and I came here in 1955 to teach school, and I met my husband in the drugstore about a year later when he came back from the service, and I've lived here ever since. Dad bought 2 Angus bulls, and he put them on shorthorn cows, and then from then on he was in the Angus business, and I think that was in 1934. This was Hereford country, and everybody had Herefords, and he thought that Angus would be the coming thing, and he liked to be different, and he marched to a little different tune. Henry went to school right after we were first married and learned how to artificial inseminate. It's changed a lot since then, but at that time, they mixed the semen right in my kitchen with egg yolk and whatnot, and then they went out and did it fresh. It was pretty nasty. Since 1964, we've done totally either embryo transfer or artificial insemination. Of course, now we have a technician that comes out once a month and they collect embryos, and it's quite a scientific, they do over 2,000 transfers of embryos. But I came down to Ashland because that was one of 2 programs that offered the piano program, and that's what I really wanted to teach. And I love this country, and it was beautiful, and of course it was 2 hours from home, and I fell in love with the country, and so I never did go. I was offered the opportunity to teach here, and so I came and taught those 2 years. We built a home out on the ranch, and it was in the middle of a wheat field, and there wasn't a blade of grass, there wasn't one tree, and of course now there's a huge tree belt. But that first summer we never pulled a weed because the wind blew just like it does today, and the sand blew, and I know that the day after he drilled the grass seed, why, most of it blew into Oklahoma, so we just didn't pull anything that summer. And then our 2 older sons particularly talk about when they were little boys about having to hoe the tree belts and water the trees and get them established, and oh, what a pain it was. But they make a big story out of it. And I've lived here 54 years. This is my home, and I love it, and I think it's a very unique place.
Is there anything that strikes you about Nan Gardner's story?
What I love about Nan Gardner's story is that very rarely do we hear about pioneer women. You know what I mean? And about, she is Mrs. Gardner, but she was very much a part of that operation and very much a part of that dynasty. And they now have, you know, 3 sons, 9 grandkids, and she's really keeping the family flag rolling. And so it's a fascinating story. She's obviously a very strong woman, and it was a real pleasure to meet her.
And is Angus now a big thing in Kansas?
It's a big thing everywhere. I mean, now even you can go by Burger King and see, you know, Angus burgers. It's considered the best meat for eating. And so her family was really, you know, they saw that coming years and years ago. And now internationally, their breed is very popular. They actually publish catalogs, and people come to Ashland, Kansas from all over the world to get the Gardner seed.
Well, Peggy Lowe is a reporter for Harvest Public Media. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Harvest Public Media is an agricultural reporting service based at KCUR in collaboration with other public media stations across the Midwest. We'll be airing My Farm Route stories on Casey Currents over the next 8 weeks. You can also hear them Wednesdays on Morning Edition. To find out how to share your own story, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/myfarmroutes.
After the break, take a ride on one of Kansas City's new rental bicycles. Plus, with the All-Star Games generating more tourist traffic, locals share what they think visitors should take away from their time in Kansas City. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Kansas City was getting ready for the All-Star Game. UMKC announced possible locations for a proposed downtown arts campus. And do you need to be reminded? It was hot. KCUR's Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Temperatures will likely ease for the coming week, but this week, the heat and accompanying drought brought no-burn orders and fireworks bans to many area communities. Johnson County Sheriff Frank Denning commented,
"It does cause a potential threat for communities and for housing areas."
Debate was hot over the Affordable Care Act. Now that the Supreme Court has ruled, it's up to the states to decide whether to form online health care exchanges, which are legal, and whether to expand Medicaid, now that the penalty for not doing that has been declared unconstitutional. Expansion supporters included Ryan Barker with the Missouri Foundation for Health.
Say single mom, 2 kids. For her to be eligible for Medicaid in Missouri, she has to make less than $3,500 a year currently. That's about 18% of the federal poverty level.
But State Senator Brad Lager wanted a special legislative session to opt out of the health care law. He didn't get it. He's running in the primary against Missouri Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder, who filed suit this week over proposed ballot language for a ballot measure that would require a vote of the legislature or the people before a Missouri health care exchange could be established.
The use of the active verb to deny individuals, families, and small businesses the ability to access affordable health care plans, that is loaded bias language on its face.
Democratic Missouri U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill got off the health care fence, reaffirming her support for the Affordable Care Act. And she took on Republican proposals for a voucher system for Medicare.
They want the federal government to give seniors a certain amount of money, and then seniors are on their own to go into the private insurance market, find an insurance policy they can afford. They want seniors to be arm wrestling insurance bureaucrats for their health care.
Meanwhile, insurance companies had to comply with the law, and most were preparing rebate checks for their clients as required. The VA and the Missouri courts announced the region's first drug court veterans program. Missouri Supreme Court Justice William Ray Price told a group in Jackson County that more than incarceration is needed.
And don't they deserve more? They deserve to be helped, not arrested. and Veterans Court will do that.
All veterans taking part will be supervised by a probation officer. Kansas City was busy preparing for Tuesday's Major League Baseball All-Star Game, and at a ribbon cutting for a fan event at Bartle Hall, George Brett joked about being the designated Kansas City ambassador.
I did milk it at home a little bit. I had my wife start calling me Mr. Ambassador, and after Tuesday, that title does go away.
450 reporters will be covering the game. Wrapping up the week, three possible sites were announced for a proposed UMKC Downtown Arts Campus, two in the Crossroads Arts District and one near Barney Alice Plaza. The Missouri Supreme Court upheld the law that requires a renewal vote on Kansas City's e-tax every 5 years, and William Whitener, Artistic Director of the Kansas City Ballet, announced that he'll leave that position at the end of the season to expand his association with choreographer Twyla Tharp. This is KCUR.
A new bicycle rental program called B-Cycle launched in Kansas City last week. By mid-morning on Tuesday, dozens of organizers and volunteers rode 90 newly assembled bikes into downtown and placed them at recently installed stations around the area. The new program is similar to ones that already exist in Washington, D.C., Denver, and other cities around the world. But how well will it translate to Kansas City? KCUR's Alana Gordon went out on a test ride to check it out.
It's a little after 5 p.m. and a little over 100 degrees out when I meet up with Eric Rogers, director of B-Cycle.
We are at the 19th and Wyandotte B-Cycle station.
Rogers has agreed to take me on a ride. He's familiar with the terrain.
I am a longtime bike commuter. I've been biking to work for about 12, 15 years now.
The starting point of our trip is in front of B-Cycle's main office. The station here consists of a long, light gray metal frame that's secured in the sidewalk. It has slots for 11 bikes. At one end is a map of downtown with the different stations marked on it. At the other is a kiosk with a computer touchscreen. How it works is you buy a membership, ranging anywhere from a day to a year.
So you put your card on the station and it'll beep for you to let you know that you've successfully checked out a bike, and then you just pull it out of the dock. And then you can just take the bike and be on your way to wherever you need to go.
You want to go for a ride?
Yeah, let's go for a ride.
All right, I'll follow you. Rogers lends me a helmet and a water bottle, and then we're off. Heading east on 19th Street, we turn left on Baltimore and head north toward 12th Street. It's a slight hill, but not too bad. These bikes, they don't look like your typical road bike or your typical mountain bike per se. What kind of bikes are they?
No, these would be more of what you would think of as a cruiser bike. They're definitely not a bike that you would use in a race or mountain biking or, you know, even on a day-long trail ride. They're the utilitarian bikes meant for short trips in an urban environment.
So things are starting to get a little narrower.
Yep. We're down in the loop now, the downtown loop, I guess is what folks call it, within the freeways.
Are there a lot of bike lanes downtown, or how do you kind of share the road with cars?
No, there are not a lot of bike lanes downtown yet, or really many places in Kansas City for that matter. So you have to share the road with the cars, use the same space that the cars are using. It's really a matter of just asserting yourself on the road as a cyclist and being cautious, following all of the same rules of the road that motorists are expected to follow. So things like stopping at stop signs, stopping at red lights, signaling when you're going to make a turn, things like that.
I have to say, there's not that many cars or people around. We think it could be the heat. At this point, I'm already sweating. Definitely time for a water break.
So we started out at 19th and Wyandotte, and now we are here at 13th and Grand. We are across the street from the Sprint Center and the Power and Light District.
And that probably took us, what, like 20 minutes?
It probably took us about 15 altogether.
This looks a lot bigger than the station where we were.
Yeah, this station here has 15 docks. The stations vary in size, anywhere from 9 to 15 or so. This is a larger station because we're here at a major destination with the Sprint Center and the Power and Light District.
How did you decide where to put the stations?
We did a pretty detailed study of the city. We looked at a lot of factors like the density of residents, the density of businesses, where all of the visitor attractions were located. We consider the topography. Kansas City is definitely not a flat city. There are a lot of hills and valleys here. So we looked at all of those factors and then determined where we thought the stations would be most successful and most useful. The good thing is these stations are not completely permanent. If we find that one location just is not working, we can move it to another location.
At this point, I see some people walking in our direction from across the street. So I ask them what they think about renting a bike downtown.
My name's Cynthia Gonzalez. Sounds interesting. Something new and more adventurous to do.
Glenda Ventura. I probably wouldn't do it though. It's so convenient just to get in the car. I'm so used to it. It's different to just get on a bike.
Michael Herschel. I'm from Jefferson City, Missouri. I doubt it just for the fact that you would get sweaty and stuff when you do actually bike and then to the restaurant, then you have your date.
I think they're representative of a lot of folks that are probably maybe a little interested in bicycling, but are hesitant to try it, aren't sure how to go about doing it, and have a lot of those practical concerns about, you know, showing up at work sweaty or...
For a date.
Or a date, although I'll say I've certainly gone out to dinner with my wife on a bike and had a good time.
Each of the 12 stations cost about $50,000, and they're being funded through private sponsorships and the fees people pay to rent the bikes. Rogers hopes the program will someday expand to other parts of the city. But for now, he and other backers of the program will have to wait and see what happens after this month's launch and whether residents and visitors are willing to give biking around downtown a try. Reporting for KC Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
With the All-Star Games here, Kansas City is expected to have a lot of extra activity this week. KC Currents intern Zach Lewandowski went by the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library to ask residents what they thought visitors should do while in town.
One thing you can't go wrong with here is the barbecue. Any of the barbecue places are phenomenal.
Well, of course, Gates Barbecue.
My favorite is Oklahoma Joe's.
Big T's is another barbecue place.
And not just because it tastes great, but it's inside a little tiny Shamrock gas station.
I tried Cafe Gratitude yesterday on Southwest Boulevard. Loved it. It's a great place. Vegan restaurant.
We have the Toy Museum here also.
Governor Stumpy's, Gregory and Oak, I believe it is.
I found that the art scene is really vibrant and exciting.
If they like blues, then I take them to BB's Lawnside Barbecue. I think it's 85th. Yeah, and they have live music, and the food's pretty good.
The water park for the kids, the new Slitterbaum, but it's in Kansas City, Kansas. But it is nice. And Worlds of Fun and Oceans of Fun. Crown Center is a nice place if they want to do other events. As well. The Plaza, of course.
Downtown,
oh, yeah, downtown.
Totally
yeah,
I know you and younger than me, but now it is. But it makes me seem like I'm in a whole nother city. I'm like, wow, because I'm used to it when Cake Box and Penny Arcade was down there, and now it's
he's
like,
telling his age.
And now when I go down there and walk, I'm like, wow, make me feel like I'm out of town.
That was Angela and Tom Carson, Holly Grafe, Ian Radford, Don Madden, Letitia, and Frederick. They spoke to KC Currents intern Zach Lewandowski.
Thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear each of the individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producers Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.